Welcome to SCOTUscast, Equal Protection Clause Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 9, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Fisher v. University of Texas at Austin. This is the second time the case has come before the High Court. Abigail Fisher, a white female, applied for admission to the University of Texas but was denied. Fisher sued the university and argued that the use of race as a consideration in the admissions process violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The district court held that the university's admissions process was constitutional, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit affirmed. The case went to the Supreme Court, Fisher won, which held that the appellate court erred in how it applied the strict scrutiny standard, improperly deferring to the university's good faith in its use of racial classifications. On remand, the Fifth Circuit again ruled in favor of the university, deeming its use of race in the admissions process narrowly tailored to a legitimate interest in achieving the rich diversity that contributes to its academic mission. The question in this case is whether the Fifth Circuit's re-endorsement of the University of Texas at Austin's use of racial preferences in undergraduate admissions decisions can be sustained under this court's decisions interpreting the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, including Fisher 1. To discuss the case, we have Joshua P. Thompson, who is principal attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Thompson.
Full disclosure, I'm Joshua Thompson. We filed, Pacific Legal Foundation filed an amicus brief, eight amicus briefs in this case, as the case has made its way through the courts. In the latest one on the merits of the Supreme Court, we were joined by the Center for Equal Opportunity, the American Civil Rights Institute, Reason Foundation, Individual Rights Foundation, National Association of Scholars, and Project 21. So I have an interest in this case. My talk today, I'm going to start off with the pertinent facts of the case. I'll move on to the procedural history, which is somewhat interesting in this case. We're before the Supreme Court for the second time. And then I'll give my impression of what occurred today at the court before opening up for questions. So the pertinent facts of this case begin in 1996 when the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals held that the University of Texas's race-based admissions policy was unconstitutional. And that case is called Hopwood, and in response to that decision, the University of Texas adopted a top 10% plan. The top 10% plan admitted graduates of Texas high schools into the University of Texas at Austin, so long as they graduated in the top 10% of their class. The reasoning behind the top 10% law was to increase the racial diversity of the enrollees at the University of Texas. And as a result of the top 10% law, the University of Texas did increase its racial diversity. In fact, by 2003, the diversity or the racial mix at the University of Texas, its diversity had exceeded the levels that had occurred prior to the Hopwood decision. In other words, when the University of Texas was using a race-based policy in 1996, the race-neutral policy under the top 10% plan produced greater racial diversity. Nevertheless, in 2003, the Supreme Court decided Grutter versus Bollinger, and in response to that decision, striking or holding that the University of Michigan Law School could use race in its admissions, the University of Texas decided to reintroduce race on top of its top 10% plan. So in essence, by the time we get to Ms. Fisher's case, about 75% of the class is admitted under the top 10% law, and 25% is admitted under what's called holistic review. And under this 25%, race is a factor in whether they are admitted or denied admission. Ms. Fisher was denied admission around 2007. She sued, alleging that the consideration of race, of her race, by the University of Texas in its admissions was unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. The case has then been to the Supreme Court once, and we're now there the second time. The district court for the Western District of Texas upheld the university's plan first in 2009. That was again upheld by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the full circuit court denied en banc rehearing in 2012, I believe. Supreme Court, however, accepted review and ruled that the university or the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals did not apply the correct version of strict scrutiny to the University of Texas's race-based plan. They remanded the case back to the Fifth Circuit for the Fifth Circuit to determine under a more stringent scrutiny whether race was absolutely necessary for the university to achieve the educational benefits of diversity and whether the benefits that are attendant to racial diversity outweighed the costs that are undeniable. The Fifth Circuit once again upheld the program. It largely reaffirmed its earlier decision, applying the new language from the first Supreme Court Fisher decision. And again, the full Fifth Circuit denied en-banc rehearing. Abigail Fisher petitioned the Supreme Court a second time. They accepted the case, and we are before the court today. Now, the issue before the court today is ultimately a merits issue. It is now that the Supreme Court has clearly defined what strict scrutiny means in Fisher 1, does this policy that considers race as admissions, despite the success of the race-neutral top 10% law, does the race-conscious component of the admissions policy satisfy strict scrutiny? So that brings us to today. And today, the Supreme Court heard argument from counsel for Fisher, counsel for the University of Texas, and counsel for the United States, who was arguing on behalf of the university. The argument went very long today. Since it was the only oral argument on the court's docket, the court extended 10 extra minutes to each side. That gave counsel for the petitioner Fisher 40 minutes, counsel for the university 30 minutes, and counsel for the United States 20 minutes. So the whole argument went an hour and a half. When analyzing what happened at the court, I think all eyes are obviously going to be on Justice Kennedy. But before I get to my view of what Justice Kennedy had to say, I want to talk about the main points of contention for the attorneys for Fisher and the main points of contention for the University of Texas. Clearly, the justices that were most concerned with Fisher's arguments were Justices Sotomayor, Justice Breyer, and Justice Ginsburg. And the first point of contention that attorneys for Fisher faced were Justice Ginsburg was concerned, as she wrote in her original dissent in Fisher 1, whether the top 10% law itself was a race-based classification. If it was motivated by race and it had a racial outcome, shouldn't that also be struck down? Or why are you arguing over the small racial component in the 25% that are admitted and not arguing over this, what she views as a greater race-based policy? The answer to that was provided by Justice Kennedy, who pushed back on Ginsburg and said that while it may have been motivated by race, it's a neutral framework, and this neutral framework does not require race-based considerations, and therefore it shouldn't require the same type of scrutiny. Counsel for Fisher also disputed that the top 10% law itself was race-based, saying that it's not his job to question the legislature's motivation, something that probably appealed to Justice Scalia, and that the legislature could have had a lot of different motivations behind adopting the top 10% law. For example, he said they could have wanted geographic diversity. They could have felt that that was a better way to ensure graduates at the university level, but it's not his job to question the motivation behind the top 10% law. I think the most difficult questioning of attorneys for Fisher came from Justice Breyer. And Justice Breyer was concerned with if you are conceding, which they did concede, that race may be considered under Grutter and Bakke to a certain extent, if you are conceding that race can be a consideration in admissions, then what could the university do here that they didn't? How could they use race? And counsel for Fisher possibly misunderstanding the question. responded that the university could perhaps increase the top 10% law, could increase to 12%. They could do other race-neutral measures to increase the diversity at the campus. But Justice Breyer continued pressing and saying that those are race-neutral measures. If you're conceding that they can use race, how, in fact, could they use race in a constitutional manner that you wouldn't object to? What counsel for Fisher responded was that you needed some sort of individualized consideration, that this was more of a blanket preference on the basis of race, and was somewhat difficult in getting a clear answer. However, Justice Scalia at that point jumped in and noted that it isn't the petitioner's job to determine when race should be used. The burden is in strict scrutiny on the other party, and they need to establish that it couldn't be done another way. So it shouldn't be on the petitioner to prove that race can be used limitedly. It's on the burden is on the government to demonstrate that race could not needed to be used. That kind of killed that line of questioning, and shortly thereafter, we moved on to the counsel for the University of Texas. University of Texas was pushed pretty strongly by Justices Alito, Scalia, and Roberts, the Chief Justice. I think that there were four themes that came through in their questioning. The first was from Justice Alito that he considered the policy that the university was pressing and the justification that they were pressing to be very pernicious and stereotypical. The university's primary argument is that they need this additional race consideration on top of the top 10% admittees because they need a diversity within diversity. They need students who are minority from diverse backgrounds. The top 10% law, they argue, only works because it admits students from poor schools, and that just so happens that there are racially segregated schools in Texas, and we need this race-conscious component in order to ensure we have more affluent or at least different students of racial minorities admitted. Justice Alito found this to be quite a pernicious classification, saying that this viewed those who are admitted under the top 10% negatively, that they couldn't contribute the right type of diversity. And he harped on that quite a bit. The University of Texas's response was to say that this wasn't stereotyping, that instead we just want a quite diverse field of students. I think the main questioning that came against the University of Texas was, how do you measure the effect and how do you know when it's achieved? Those kind of relate to go together. So a lot of the questioning concerned what type of effect does the consideration of race with those 25% of the admittees, what kind of effect does that have? In other words, if you just eliminated the race and you still had a holistic review that considered leadership, it considered socioeconomic, it considered all these other factors, wouldn't you still achieve a very racially diverse class and a class that's diverse across a lot of different fields? And there was a lot of discussion about how do you measure the extent of this minor racial component. On the one hand, the University of Texas didn't want to say that it had a profound effect, but they also couldn't say that it had a little effect. The more profound effect, the more pernicious the stereotype is, but the more minor the effect, the less it's needed. And I think that the University of Texas, if they had to pick from those two, wanted to lean towards showing that it has a significant effect and admits a certain percentage of minority individuals, students that would not have otherwise been admitted. But they couldn't point to any evidence. There was no evidence, and that was continuously harped on again by counsel for the petitioner, that their theory that this has a significant effect is unsubstantiated by the record. and it was their burden to produce that evidence in the record. Relatedly, the Chief Justice questioned whether the 25-year clock from Grutter, in Grutter the court said that racial preferences would not be needed in 25 years, if that was going to be met by the university's race-based policy. Of course, the university and the Solicitor General punted on that question, saying that, you know, we don't think that's a set clock and that we believe that these are working and that we will know when they are no longer needed, but we can't say for sure when they're no longer needed. So the Chief Justice, again, pressed on that point that what will we need, when will we know, what sort of evidence can you produce to know that we don't need preferences any longer? And there was, to my opinion, no clear-cut answer to that question. So that brings me to the elephant in the room. How was Justice Kennedy viewing all of this? I think everybody recognizes that he will be the swing vote in this case, although Justice Kagan, it should be noted, has recused herself from this case because she worked on it while she was in the Department of Justice. Still, if it was a 4-4 opinion, with Justice Kennedy siding with Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg, that would be a win for the University of Texas, and that would be the end of the case. So all eyes are on Justice Kennedy, and he had questions for both sides. As I noted earlier, he pushed back on Ginsburg on the top 10% idea. He also felt with Justice Alito that there was a certain stereotyping component of the university's race-based policy. However, he also had a number of questions about remand. One of the things the University of Texas has urged is if the court does not take the case or does not decide the case in its favor, that the court should remand it for further fact-finding. So Justice Kennedy had a lot of questions on that, asking some what kind of evidence would they put in, what additional fact-finding would you need, and a lot of questions along that line of thinking. Ultimately, however, he did say it's at one point during the argument that based on the answers they had been giving him, that it seems like remand won't help them, that it doesn't, they couldn't articulate any evidence or any data that they needed to put in the record that they didn't. So since that was really the only questioning that Kennedy gave that gave pause to those in favor of equality under the law, I think the questioning from Kennedy was quite favorable. A few last points before I open it up to questioning. I think a couple of interesting moments in the argument. You'll probably be reading about Scalia had a comment about mismatch, saying something to the effect of you know, African Americans who get into the University of Texas aren't necessarily better off, that they would do better if they went to an institution where they're more academically qualified, and that most scientists and most engineers come from of minority backgrounds don't come from the elite universities because they aren't academically qualified to handle them. Now, he didn't say that, I think, in the smoothest way possible, and it came off quite uncouth, perhaps. And I think a lot of the papers will probably seize on that language. Also, I think the Chief Justice had an interesting moment when the discussion centered around how do you measure whether these policies are working? How do you measure whether racial isolation on campus is decreasing? And the attorney for the university said, well, we have these surveys that we hand out to students to ask whether they're feeling racially isolated. And he quickly jumped in and called those surveys sophomoric, that, you know, asking somebody these broad questions is not a rigorous standard, and it really doesn't tell us any information about when these race-based policies will cease.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.